Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of thepaleomom.com. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
So, Stacey, I'm really excited about our guest this week. So excited that I'm totally jumping in on your normal job of opening the show and saying hi to me, and I'm starting it. Are you like...
I'm super jazzed to see how this turns out, because the less than a dozen times that we've done this has always been interesting, but...
Slash entirely awkward and terrible.
But also super fun and exciting, and I think that it's totally appropriate for the show, so I'm excited for you to kick it off.
Woohoo! Well, I'm excited too, because we have Sarah Ramsden on the show, and we actually both met Sarah, I think, for the first time at our book signing in Toronto in January.
Yeah, I think I might have... Sarah, did I meet you before at a Paleo FX, or was that just this year's Paleo FX?
I think I met you at last year's.
That's what
and
I thought.
You just finished doing some squats, and I approached you at a really inopportune moment.
Well, I don't think it was inopportune. it's always nice to meet people, and I thought I remembered, because you have very pretty eyes, and I thought I remembered meeting you. So, anyway, but it was very brief, whatever it was. So yeah. It was nice to connect a little more in the Toronto signing.
Well, and Sarah just moved to Parksville, British Columbia, which is really close to where my family is. So we got an opportunity to connect while I was on my trip home, and we just had so much fun. I was like, oh, we have to keep talking.
Yeah.
let's do it via podcast, because if we're going to have such interesting conversations, we should share this with everybody, right? That's sort of my philosophy on things. So, so Sarah, welcome to the Paleo View podcast. This is
Thank you, ladies. Pretending
to do Stacey's job, which is always awkward. Stacey, I'm going to make you ask questions later or something.
Is it awkward when I do it? It's just awkward for you.
It's totally just awkward for me, because I'm usually the responder, not the instigator. So I normally just have to sit back and like laugh. Like just laugh at some, giggle at something that you say, and then go, yeah, that's awesome. Right? I like, because that's pretty much right there. That's my job. That's my, and then geek out later. But at the beginning, I just have to like sit back and let you do it. So now we'll see. Okay. So Sarah, I just really wanted to have you on the show. You have one of the most inspiring stories, I think, in the entire community. And I really wanted to be able to share that story with our listeners. And I thought the best way to do that was to have you actually here do it yourself, because it's, you know, it'd be a little bit awkward if I was just like, I met this girl named Sarah. And all this stuff happened.
And so I would be like, were you looking in the mirror again?
Right. And I'd be like, no, this is actually stuff that didn't happen to me. as much as my health history is kind of like a drama novel too, Sarah's is much more so.
But, mine's a big drama novel, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, they could make a television series out of your story, I'm pretty sure. So why don't you introduce yourself and talk about how you... you know, came to be such a, you know, vibrant and huge contributing member to this paleo movement.
Oh, well, where to begin? Let's start maybe 7-8 years ago. I lose track, to be honest. I had a crazy year, and Sarah, I'm sure you can speak to the power of stress in this situation once I'm done this bit, but, they say you should only do one of these things per year, and that's, you know, plan a wedding, move house, plan a trip across the country, you know, get married. I did all these things in 1 year. So You know, I got engaged. I was, you know, the company that we both worked for offered us positions in London in the UK. We were at that time, we were in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And so we started planning a move back to the UK where I'm originally from. And that fell through. And then the Toronto office were like, hey, Sarah, we want you to come work here. So we started moving, planning this move to Toronto, all while we're planning our wedding. You know, we eventually got married. We sold our house while on honeymoon. We moved to Toronto a month later. We got promotions. We got a new place to live. And a month later, I couldn't feel my left hand. It was very strange, you know, I figured out, you know, I finally realized how bad it was when I was out. I was in a bar one night. It was really packed in downtown Toronto. And I'm really like protective of my personal space. And someone like hit my hand. And I was just like inside, I was like, oh, so irate because someone was just like too close to me. And but I looked up and all it was my friends around me. There was no one else there kind of intruding on my space. And I realized that I had hit my own hand, you know, while gesticulating, while talking. And I was like, oh, I can't feel my hand, my left hand. And, you know, and then quickly, you know, as a runner at the time, I was running half marathons. I realized also my gait was off. So my left foot was scuffing. Not enough for anyone else to really notice visually that something was wrong with my gait. But, you know, you get pretty tuned into these things, you know, when you start really getting used to certain movements. And so I still didn't have a doctor or anything. So I took myself to a walking doctor in Toronto. And luckily they're pretty, I guess the word is paranoid, because they don't have any of your health history. So they do every test under the sun. And he was all, oh, we're going to book you in for a CT scan and a this and a that. And he's telling me how it's probably neurological, you know, and he was partially joking around saying, you know, hopefully it's just something like multiple sclerosis and not something like Lou Gehrig's disease. And I had no idea what he was talking about at the time, but I went back to work after my lunch break and after my doctor's appointment and, you know, joked around with my team because I had a big team that I led there as a graphic designer at the time and said, oh yeah, he said, you know, it's probably just neurological and, you know, and not understanding what that meant. I just thought that, you know, I was joking around saying, you know, you all know that I'm crazy and, you know, whatever, I do crazy things. And I just didn't get what that meant or the severity of what that meant. So a week later, I had my CT scan and the technician said, oh, the doctor will call you next week probably. But he called me the next day and said, you need to come back in and see me. So I go back into this walking doctor. I couldn't even remember his name. And in the process of this like 10, 20 minute consult, he starts off saying, oh, so Sarah, your scan came back and turns out you have a lesion on your brain. And I don't know about you two, but when someone says you have a lesion, it's kind of like, oh, I have a blister or a little bump, right? A lesion is pretty a benign thing.
I don't think you want anything on your brain though.
No, but if it's going to be something, like a lesion sounds like, to me, it sounded like a water blister. Like I was like, okay, I have a lesion, all right?
It sounds like it's on the surface of your brain, right? Like it's...
Right.
doesn't sound like it's in your brain.
Right. And yeah. So, but by the end of this conversation, it had turned, the word lesion has somehow morphed into the word tumor. And I was like, wait. 10 minutes ago, you called this a lesion, and to me, this is just this little bump, but now it's a tumor. And he's like, yes, you have a tumor on your brain. You have what's called an olfactory groove meningioma, which is a tumor that sits on the olfactory groove in the brain, which is where the olfactory nerves, so the nerves that connect your nose to the brain, run along this little groove. And that's where the tumor was, essentially right in the middle of my head. So if you kind of put your, you know, draw sight lines between your eyes and between your ears, it's kind of around there. And I was like, okay. And he's like, it's about the size of a golf ball and you need to have brain surgery. So I was like, okay. And
lesion, and now golf ball sized tumor.
Yeah. And my lesion, my blister has turned into a golf ball. And, and this was 3 weeks before Christmas. And I had my Christmas honeymoon in Paris planned, and which everything had to be canceled because I didn't have clearance to fly or to travel or anything. And before I knew it, I had brain surgery, a craniotomy booked for 6 weeks later, so at the end of January.
By the way, just for American listeners, 6 weeks to surgery by Canadian healthcare standards is like emergency fast. That is crazy fast.
I know. I don't know whether
like you jumped all the lines to get surgery in 6 weeks in Canada.
I don't know whether it was just the time of year, because they try not to have people having major surgeries in December because it keeps them around hospital potentially. But anyway. I had a neurosurgeon within 2 weeks and, you know, all this stuff. But it kind of bothered me because every doctor I spoke to was like, oh, this is just weird, though, because your symptoms just don't align with the position of your tumor. And, you know, after having the GP, like the, I guess that's an HMO in the States, the regular doctor say this, and then the neurosurgeon say this, I'm like, okay, hang on a second. You've booked me in for neurosurgery, but you don't know where these symptoms are coming from, because it's clearly it's not from the tumor. I was very, very lucky because my boss at work was like, you know what, Sarah, you're not going into this surgery without this, without these answers, because we'd already had two people in my office, unfortunately, come down with cancer and pass away. And so she was like, I'm not taking any risks, Sarah. Like, she paid for me personally to go down to the States, down to Buffalo, which is a few hours drive from Toronto, and have an MRI there. Like, so I had that MRI the same week that I was diagnosed with the brain tumor. And the notes from the tech notes came back within a day saying, you know, demyelination. And I knew immediately without seeing a neurologist that that meant multiple sclerosis. So before I, you know, within the same week, I basically got the diagnosis that I had a brain tumor and I had multiple sclerosis. So there's some like severe inflammation going on in my brain, essentially. So I had my answers, you know, and I could, you know, my neurosurgeon was fine with that diagnosis in conjunction with brain surgery. So I went in, I had brain surgery. But, you know, I just really had this profound moment on the way to the hospital because I woke up that morning. And my surgery was scheduled for like 10 in the morning or something. But then we'd had a massive snowfall. So there's like 2 feet of snow on the ground. There was no way we could drive to the hospital. We had to take public transport, which is kind of the last thing you want to do in, you know, take the gross train to hospital to have your brain kind of manhandled. Right. so I'm on the public transport. I'm on the TTC in Toronto, which is like an underground style train. I'm just sat there and it's rush hour and there's people going to work looking miserable as hell, as they always do on those, you know, in rush hour in the train. And I'm just like, wow, you know, I'm going to have brain surgery. And by the time these people come home, I'll be in neuro ICU. Like, I was just processing this massive thing that was going to happen to me that day. And all these people look so, so miserable, you know, and I'm going to go have my head cut open, my brain manhandled. Yet people continue to live their lives in such a way that they're just miserable. So that was just like this first thought, kind of thought that came to my head and really was the first thing that spurred this kind of change in my life. So I ultimately had brain surgery. I had a craniotomy. They removed the tumor. It was not cancerous. You know, the medical community describe it as being benign, but, those people who have benign brain tumors, we never describe them as being benign because they can have massive ramifications depending on where they are in the brain. So as a result of the surgery, I lost my sense of smell. So I'm now what you call an anosmiac, which means I can't smell anything. But
anos. It sounds like you should be afraid of like anions. What, like afraid of?
It's called anosmia. And then you're an anosmiac. So it's the equivalent of being blind or deaf. It's but for the sense of smell. Because the brain is kind of like, what is it when people have amputations and they still feel that limb?
Phantom leg syndrome or phantom limb syndrome. Yeah.
Right. So I had olfactory hallucinations for a good year or two after the surgery. And for the first 6 months, it was continuously smelling things that did not exist, whether that be oranges or chemicals. Chemicals was the main one, or flowers or something like very, very obnoxious floral.
It tended to be like not good smells?
Most of the time, yeah. So now, 7 years later, I might get a whiff of a bunch of flowers every now and again, and I'm just like, oh, flowers, that's fantastic. It's like, gives a whole new meaning to, you know, stop and smell the roses. But yeah, so now I don't smell anything, and that, and you know, I get a lot of emails from people asking me about how I deal with that and how they're really depressed that they don't have a sense of smell anymore like me. And I'm like, honestly, it was my smell or my eyesight at the end of the day, if I had just left that tumor to grow. So not having a sense of smell I see as being a big benefit, because I can go to public washrooms. As far as I'm concerned, they are sparkling clean and don't smell. So I'm good with that. You know, I can go to the bathroom whilst everyone's outside just like refusing to go in.
So you do not have the intense instinctual revulsion to porta potties that I have, is what you're saying?
No, I don't care. I really don't care.
Okay, so there's benefits.
But, you know, I know intellectually that this is really disgusting, so I don't touch anything. but, you know, when I'm camping and there's, you know, only porta potty toilets, I'm fine. So yeah. And then, so I had 3 months off work, essentially recovering from that. And, you know, I was only in hospital for 2 nights. I had like a bunch of staples all across my head, and, they let me go home. And within a week I was out walking the dog in the snow with like a staple, you know, a head full of staples with a hat on. And I really just started rehabbing myself, like playing card games and really, you know, walking my dog and trying to get back into exercise. And Sarah, I think I told you, I think when we were together, when we got together here on Vancouver Island, I had this thing called, what's it called? Where you can't filter out any of the stimuli coming.
Hypervigilance?
Exactly. I had really bad hypervigilance. So it was really hard for me to go places. So I would, you know, even if I went to the market or the mall, I could literally only be there for 5 minutes because we have so many thousands of stimuli coming in through all of our senses at any one time, but I just couldn't filter out any of them. So I could only be in busy places for literally for 5 minutes because the movement, the lights, the noise, everything was just flooding my brain. And I would literally go home and sleep for like four hours after that. It was just crazy. But I, you know, I rehabbed myself and I eventually got back into work, you know, starting on a four hour work schedule per week, and then building by 4 hours every week until I was slowly at a full time work schedule again. But this whole time, I realized that I just did not want to go back to my design career. Like, I was a very successful designer, you know, had worked all around the world for all Fortune 500 companies. I was always requested by my clients, like people like Citibank and Dell and Mercedes-Benz, like really big clients. And I realized I just didn't want to do that. And I found myself like crying in the shower, you know, before I was due to go back to work, just realizing I did not want to do that anymore. It just did not align with my values. So I basically gave myself a year to not make any rash decisions, because I think I had read somewhere that give yourself a year to make sure it's not just a reaction or some kind of PTSD or something like that. I gave myself a year, and eventually I actually just quit my job. I didn't give my husband any warning. I just quit one day. I had a really bad meeting. I'm like, you know what? I'm done with this. And, I quit without a plan. And, yeah, and I eventually ended up doing freelance design, which meant that I could take the time off I needed, just do whatever I wanted, and eventually decided that I wanted to go into nutrition. And this only happened after I discovered Rob Wolf's book, and, you know, I had finally had the guts to start looking into the whole MS side of things, because there's only so much you can deal with at once, right? A brain tumor and recovering from brain surgery took a whole year basically to be able to you know, fit in exercise and work at the same time and socializing, because I only had infinite amounts of energy. So eventually I was able to start looking at the MS side of things. And that was, as I said, introduced to me by Rob Wolf, and that was way back when. So, you know, the only AIP type thing back then was Lorraine Cordain's videos on YouTube around tomatoes and, you know, all that stuff, like that really old stuff. And I did that for a while, But ultimately, really just works on an anti-inflammatory diet, and I've never had to be on any kind of MS medication or anything like that, thank goodness. And I just, in my own stubbornness, have just refused it as well, and luckily have had doctors who have followed along. But that whole experience of discovering nutrition and what that could do for me really led me into nutrition school. And from there, I helped a lot of people with autoimmunity and such. But have more recently, because as Sarah said, I have moved from Toronto to Vancouver Island, where I spent a lot of time growing up, have started really moving my business from helping people with nutrition problems to helping people who have been through a chronic illness like me and have found that, you know, they're just working and healing and working and healing and just praying to get back to normal life. But once they get there, that normalcy, it just doesn't fit anymore, right? You've changed so much that, you know, something still just doesn't feel right. And it's really disappointing feeling to have gone through all that work, worked through the medical system, done all the work on yourself for healing and gotten to the other side. And you should be celebrating when really you're just like, oh, something is just doesn't feel right. So that's now what I'm moving into helping people with, is to really rediscover what really jazzes people up, because your perspective completely changes, and to really kind of redefine everything in their life to really match and to help catch up with where they're at now.
I think that's so amazing. I mean, there are so many things that are amazing about your story, but I think the power of kind of pulling through and utilizing different kinds of tools to find that personal strength to get to the other side of what you wanted to do is really amazing. I heard you say throughout your story that you had, you know, read this and had, you know, made some decisions based on research that you had done. And I think that in and of itself, to me, hearing your full story for the first time speaks volumes to the fact that it's a passion that you have and an interest that you have and something that you could definitely help other people with, because so many people just kind of struggle and feel overwhelmed. And the fact that you were able to kind of focus on, okay, you know, let me look into what, you know, what the research says or what other people are experiencing during this time and, you know, really think through this process and do what I want to do is a really powerful message that so many people could benefit from, no matter what kind of life experience they're having, you know?
Right. Absolutely. And what I had learned was that I had moved to Toronto in a whole nother lifetime, essentially, like pre-brain tumor, pre-MS. And that was a whole nother lifetime. I came out afterwards and that whole environment just did not fit for me anymore. And I see this a lot with people. And that's kind of what forced my move across the country to Vancouver Island, which is where Sarah's from. And so now I live, you know, rather than being in a basement apartment in downtown Toronto, now I live in a cabin in the woods with a massive garden. There's two horses on the property. You know, we're out hiking and swimming under waterfalls and surfing and sea kayaking like every week. Because I kind of rediscovered that I just love being outside, and that's really where my inspiration comes from. So it's amazing how I think it's very hard when you're in the midst of being sick. And if someone had said this to me, what I'm about to say, when I was in the midst of recovering from brain surgery, I would have been very insulted. But I think illness can be a gift, but we can only realize that in hindsight. Sometimes I feel that it can really be something that directs us in a different path. So maybe we've had small signs that we haven't been listening to for a while. And then suddenly your body's like, hey, raises a big white flag. You have to listen to me now. And that's when you get whatever diagnosis it is. And you have to go through that process of paying more attention to yourself and what you want. And you come out the other side and you're like, okay, now, like changing your diet and healing yourself really is a gateway drug for changing everything else in your life.
I mean, not only that, but it was the MS that actually led them to your brain tumor. And as you said, if you hadn't had the MS symptoms to go in to find out about the brain tumor, then it would have potentially caused blindness or other problems, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, that's a good observation. Yeah.
Yeah. So that in and of itself, like you just said, it can be a blessing. And in your case, I think definitely was. You're able to manage it with food, but it, you know, prevented you from losing your sight. I if it were me, that would be some, that would be a choice that I would want to make, you know?
Like, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like your sense of smell is you can lose that without really having any impact on your life. Aside from the fact I don't really taste any food, but, except,
yeah, that's a bad one.
That's pretty sad.
but if you weigh up between your eyesight and your sense of smell, like I know which one I would rather lose.
Well, if you weigh up against any other sense, I feel like the sense of smell is the most disposable. That's not really quite the right word, but disposable is what I've got. I can't think of what I mean.
Right.
But yeah, it's like the one that if you were given the choice, okay, you got to lose a sense, which one is it going to be? And you're like, oh, smell's going.
Right. Exactly. And I think half of my healing process with food, I really got into fermented foods. And that's one of the things that I can actually taste and I can tell when it's done, because that sour sense is definitely a mouth flavor as opposed to one that comes from the nose. So to give people context, about 75% of the taste of your food actually comes from the smell of it and has absolutely nothing to do with your mouth whatsoever. The rest comes from the mouth and from the tongue and sensors in the, you know, elsewhere in membranes in the mouth. So with fermented foods, I can taste that sourness. I'm really tuned into when fermented foods are done and ready to go, which is why I created my Fearless Fermentation program to really help people integrate that scary, scary food into their kind of daily kind of dinner routine. So while writing recipes is really, really challenging for me, and I don't actually do it because it just stresses me out, because I'm like, how do you write a recipe when you can't taste the food? But for fermented foods I can do. So that's where Fearless Fermentation came from, where I teach people like really the basics of really getting into fermented foods and getting over those fears and, you know, leaving food on the counter for several weeks, which really goes against everything you've ever been taught about food safety, right? You don't just leave food on the counter and then eat it several weeks later. We don't do that. But with ferments, that's what we do. So that's really what I love to – I really like to teach people how to just be fearless and be unconventional. So
so I love that you mentioned Fearless Fermentation, because it is absolutely an amazing program for people – because fermented foods are such a superfood, right? They have these two halves to the benefits of them. The one is that they're an amazing source of probiotics. And when you do wild fermentation, you get a greater diversity in probiotics in those foods than you can get anywhere else. So for example, a wild fermented sauerkraut can have as many as 680 different strains of beneficial bacteria and yeast in it, compared to that to, you know, like a supplement, like the best supplement you're going to find might have 8 or 9 strains in it.
Right. I mean, absolutely.
Right. So 680 versus 9, right? So the difference is just, I mean, you can't even compare it. It's in a completely different planet.
And so we have no idea which strains that you need, right? You can't easily tell which strains you're deficient in or you have overpopulations in. And we equally in our digestive tracts have hundreds of varieties of bacterial strains too. So
500 to 1,000 in a typical human's digestive tract. And what we know about the gut microbiome and health is that one of the best things you can have is high diversity of different strains of microorganisms in your digestive tract. Like that is the number one property of your gut microbiome that is conducive to health. And one of the ways you get that is by eating a variety of different types of vegetables, right? Different types of food for different types of bacteria that might be growing in your digestive tract. But the other way is to inoculate your digestive tract with tons of different strains, right? And you get that from wild ferments in a way that you don't get from a supplement.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, in Fearless Fermentation, I have the sauerkraut, because everyone is obsessed with I have sauerkraut, but I was going to say kombucha. Everyone is obsessed with kombucha. So I have that in there. I feel like that's more of a liver tonic than being super rich in bacteria, but it's there because, you know, people love it. And then, of course, I have the sauerkraut in there because that's the first and easiest of the vegetable ferments. But then I also teach people how to brine vegetables. So you can ferment pretty much any vegetable out there. You know, I really love fermenting cauliflower with some turmeric and raisins and apple. Like it's really, you can ferment almost anything that comes out of your garden or from the grocery store, as well as I do water kefir as well. So really being cognizant of the paleo community, and then not everyone can tolerate dairy. So I went for the water kefir because that's another one there, but it's also very quick. So our kombucha, it can take us a couple of weeks to ferment, whereas water kefir will take you 24 to 48 hours. So that's a, for different people with different schedules, that's another option as well to get that kind of fizzy drink fix.
Well, and kefir and kombucha are a little bit different from brined vegetables or sauerkraut in the sense that they have beneficial, a lot more yeast, beneficial yeast, not like yeast overgrowth yeast, a different strain, and bacteria. And they both typically have on the order of about 40 strains, including bacteria and yeast. That's still a huge, like, increase over a supplement. Like, typically, like, there's only one strain of yeast that's ever in probiotic supplements.
Yeah.
So when you do kombucha or kefir, you're getting a couple dozen strains, which is, you know, really, really amazing. We know that actually the beneficial strains of yeast, to get all geeky, in kombucha and kefir actually help control the growth of pathogenic yeast like candida. It's one of the best things you can do if you have, if you've been diagnosed with bacterial overgrowth or candida overgrowth, is incorporate these foods into your diet because they help to rein in the growth of pathogenic bacteria and yeast.
Fascinating.
So the other benefit though to fermented foods, and I think it's one that we actually don't talk about enough. I think we're always talking about the probiotics. We don't talk enough about the absorbability of the nutrients in probiotic food, in these fermented foods, because what happens is it's like we're growing them in a culture that is designed to allow these beneficial bacteria and yeast to grow and not allow pathogenic, right? That's why we add the salt, right? So we don't get pathogenic bacteria in there. We're just getting the good stuff that will ferment them. But it's kind of like when it's sitting on your counter and doing that scary thing of just sitting there and kind of bubbling a little bit occasionally, it's actually those bacteria are pre-digesting that food for us. And one of the things that it does is it makes the nutrients in the food far more bioavailable, and those foods are far easier to digest. And when you're dealing with chronic illness where, you know, gut health is part of the pathology, which is very, very common, then having these foods that are sort of pre-digested for you, I don't know if that, I just realized that probably sounds really gross to a lot of people, but it's not supposed to, because it's delicious. But those, having those foods that are sort of partly broken down already before they get into your mouth, it's so much easier on your digestive tract, and you can get so much more nutrients from sauerkraut than you can from cabbage just for that reason.
Oh, absolutely. And then I think, you know, in my research, and correct me if I'm wrong, Sarah, but I've come across the fact that fermentation can help preserve, for example, the vitamin C content in cabbage, which is a very, you know, it's a nutrient that really
nutrient, yeah,
right, that depletes over time. And if you think about, you know, all the, you know, the fruit that we get, well, particularly in Canada, I'm speaking from our perspective, but we get a lot of fruit from other countries, and it's been sat in storage for months, and that vitamin C is severely depleted. But if you get a fresh cabbage at the right time of year, you know, when it's fresh in the store, and you ferment that in sauerkraut, you're preserving that vitamin C through the winter. Which I think is awesome as well, because that's honestly a hard nutrient for us to come by in the winter in some climates. So
definitely. There's actually, it's even more than just preservation of nutrients, because fermentation can actually form new nutrients. So some of the chemical reactions that happen. Now, granted, there, you know, there's chemical reactions that happen with chewing, for example, that can form new nutrients, or there's chemical reactions that can happen with cooking that can form new nutrients. But fermentation is one of those things that can form new antioxidants for us, which can be super, super beneficial. And we don't even actually know all of the different phytochemicals that can be formed with fermentation. It's one of the things sort of we talk a lot about when we talk about fermented cod liver oil, is that we don't even, like, we know it's got some omega-3 fats, we know it's got some vitamin A and some vitamin D, but through the fermentation process, we don't even know what kinds of short-chain fatty acids are produced. And the same goes with any fermented food. I mean, it's really, really clear from the scientific literature that it's beneficial to include these as a staple of the diet, and we don't even understand all of the ways that these things are benefiting us.
Right. And that always comes down to, you know, when you think about the probiotics versus the fermented foods, because there's so much complexity there, we can't possibly outwit nature in that respect. Right. So, you know, even if he needs to take probiotics on a therapeutic level, guided by a practitioner, ferments, you know, are an essential component too.
Absolutely. So one of, I'm just going to throw Stacey under the bus here for a second. Stacey, I hope you're okay with that.
It depends on, you know, what bus is coming and how far I'm being thrown, I guess.
So one of the things that Stacey has talked about on the podcast more than once is the challenge of home fermentation, because it's kind of, things don't grow in Stacey's house. She doesn't grow houseplants, right?
That's fair. I mean, things grow, summary? It's just like usually the wrong thing. And then the cactuses are dying. Yeah.
So yeah. It's, to me, I feel like your Fearless Fermentation program in many ways sort of bridges the gap for people like Stacey, who, is it fair to say that you're fairly intimidated by home ferments?
I've done it a couple of times, and the things that were short-term, and I love that you, I know where you're going with this, Sarah, sorry to interrupt, but I think it's cool that you break things down into things that are kind of short-term versus long-term, because that's where my problems lie, is that like...
Short-term's good, long-term not so much.
Long-term, that thing that you forget that's in your fermentation crock that then 3 months later you're like, whoa, I wasn't trying to grow all that, you know? So,
right. Yeah, leaving it for 3 months, usually not recommended, without at least checking on it and topping up the liquid levels from time to time.
I think, Stacey, you need to get your kids involved, because they would totally love it.
Yeah, they would. They would.
They would totally keep track of the calendar for you, too.
Yeah, Cole is actually growing vegetables in our garden right now. He told me earlier today, he gave me this like disappointing look on his face, and he was like, you know, everything was overgrown. I went and weeded it. I was like, good job. It's terrible. I'm really bad. But I do agree that I think that a resource that is a little more educational and patient with people like me.
For me, I think it bridges the gap between Stacey, who has generally steered clear of home fermentation, to, like, for me, I've done sauerkraut and I've done pickles and I've done milk kefir and coconut milk and I've done kombucha. But at the same time, like, I'm really like brining vegetables and knowing what I can mix in there is not something I'm super comfortable with. And I've never done water kefir. And so for me, it still provides like a really useful resource. And there's still a lot of like, oh, wait, I didn't know I could do that. Right. Those types of moments. And so I feel like it's just a fantastic resource for people to go from like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe if I just mix cabbage and salt, I'm going to get something edible out of it, to like,
wait, cabbage, salt and 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks.
Right. That's intimidating. But it's also for people who have done some fermentation. I think there's still a lot to gain out of that program. So
right.
I just
and
love
I,
that it's sort of encompasses that whole range.
And the people who are enrolled in the program have had, you know, I've had a bunch of beginners who have never done it before. And I have had people who consider themselves to be experienced fermenters, and they're like, oh, this is why I keep getting mold, you know? And to Stacey's point, like, I have, for example, on sauerkraut and the fermented veggies, I have a calendar of what to expect day by day. And this varies based on the temperature and, you know, a few kind of variables. But, you know, in days 1 to 2, not much is going to happen. But then come day 3, it's going to start fizzing. By day 5, it's overflowing, you know. So I break it down day by day so you know exactly what to expect, what's normal. It's going to overflow at this point, but then it's going to be really weird, and it's not actually like the water line isn't actually going to go down because it's expansion happening with all the gas that's being produced. But then you'll find around day 14 that suddenly you'll open that jar and check it, and the water line has gone down drastically. It's all dry. And that's when that is the critical point that you have to know is coming, because if you leave it dry, that's when it's going to go moldy, when that cabbage comes up above the waterline. So that's when you have to top it up with some more brines. So there's lots of little things that I have in there that really give you the little kind of ins and outs that really help prevent the problems that everyone is so scared of.
So I want to take a really, really large step backwards, because you were talking earlier about being on the subway on your way to brain surgery.
Ironically, to St. Mike's.
No, to St. Mike's, where I did my first postdoctoral research fellowship. Oh, Toronto. So I'm well familiar with that subway stop. But you were doing some little, you know, observations of people around you and noting that, you know, the people weren't looking happy. And it's one of the things I know that you have really sought for yourself in your life is happiness first. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that I know that you're really passionate about helping other people find. And I kind of wanted to bring us back to that thought before we run out of time. Because so fun fact about me, for as long as I can remember, hopefully this will not negate all my birthday wishes for all the time. But for as long as I can remember, when I blow out the candles on my birthday cake, my wish is to be happy. That is the, I mean, I've done that probably since I was 9 or 10 years old. I blow out the candles and I kind of feel like if I wish to be happy, like it doesn't matter what those other things are, right? Like, you know, in my teens, I could have wished to be thin, but I didn't wish to be thin. I wished to be happy. And I felt like that everything else would have to come together for that to happen. And that was the most important thing. And I really like that life focus, right? So that mm-hmm. how can I make my other choices so that at the end of the day, my default emotion, the way that I feel walking through the majority of my life is happy. What are the things that I need to prioritize? What are the things that I can let slide? How do I change the course of my life or direct my life so that that's the thing that happens? Like happiness is the number one thing. And that doesn't mean happiness instead of success, right? It doesn't mean happiness instead of the super high profile job that you spent, you know, 20 years in school to get. But it means that happiness is part of the criteria for success and for life and for choices, right? When you're doing the pros and cons list, it's like, and which one of these things will make me happy? Or which one of these things will down the road, right, contribute to happy. And I just love that perspective. So I want to give you a go, Sarah.
Well, I think also you mentioned success. You have to define as well, what is your definition of success? So if I can use my story as an example, if I go back before everything went kind of crazy in my life with my health, you know, my definition of success was getting the next big client, getting the next big portfolio piece as a graphic designer, getting the next promotion and the next pay raise. That was my definition of success. Now, you know, and after many 7 years of working and changing, my definition of success is enjoying my life, being outdoors and all of, you know, enjoying all of the health benefits that that brings. It's not my salary. It's in my business, it's what I can give to people and how I can help other people. So my definition of success is very, very different. Not that I don't want financial, you know, gain and to be, you know, be able to pay my way and everything, but that is not my my modus operandi anymore. It's about helping other people. And so when you're looking at your own happiness, it's like, first of all, you have to think about the things that really excite you. And the things that make you, you know, leave you feeling heavy, you know, you have to think about what are you saying yes to that really doesn't light you up? What are you saying yes to that that you feel obligated to say yes to? Because every time you say yes to something that you're kind of like, meh, yeah, you know, I feel like I have to do that, you are actually saying no to something else and filling up a space that something else awesome could have used. Right. So by starting, first of all, the first step is to start saying no to things that you don't feel like jazzed about, to be honest. And that can be anything from relationships to work, like even just working overtime, you know, thinking about what is important to you. If your family is the most important thing to you, why are you working 14-hour days every day? Like that's not, you're not working towards your happiness or really your true definition of success. So really even just sitting down and writing down all the things are the most important to you. What are the things that really, really excite you? And then looking at, okay, am I allowing myself in my life to do those things and to give those things that are most important to me? They're 100% of my, or, you know, of my attention outside of, you know, the necessities I have to cover in my life. So, and it might be that maybe you have to get, for argument's sake, a new job because, your boss expects you to work these extra hours, and really you want to be home with your kids. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with taking, for example, a pay cut to spend more time with your family if that's what is important to you and if that is what your idea of success in life is all about. Because we have this societal kind of construct of what is success. And we all just follow along with it. But really, you can stop, right? You can stop and you can really think about, is this what I want to do? If it's not what you want to do, you can, doesn't matter what everyone else thinks, you can be the person who lives in a log cabin in the middle of the woods and, you know, enjoys life on a sustainable farm. Like, that's something that I really want to do. But I don't really care if people criticize me for quitting $1,000, you know, $100,000 a year career to earn very little to do that, because that's my personal definition of success. So you really have to stop worrying about what other people think and about what society tells us is what you should be doing, and really start thinking about what you want to do. And that can take some rejigging in your life. You know, I had to, you know, leave a marriage. I had to leave a career. I had to change a lot of things to get to where I am today, so that where I'm in a place where I live in a little cabin rurally on an acreage where I can go down the road and swim under a waterfall whenever I like, or I can go sea kayaking. And these are the things that are important to me. But if what is important to you is checking out all the top restaurants in New York and that like totally lights you up, then make that happen. Find a way, have that, make a vision board, put it on your, you know, your desk, your desktop on your computer, and just make sure that every decision you make is getting you like even just 1 millimeter closer to that goal that you might have.
I think that's excellent advice. I personally had to do that last year, and it really helped me figure out, you know, what was important to me and what I wanted to kind of let go of, or what I could let go of. Because really, if I'm being honest, I think I've mentioned it a bunch of times on the show, I think all of us with autoimmune diseases are type A's who feel compelled to do everything. And, you know, for those of us that have passions or a lot of ideas, that can be really overwhelming, because you want to do it all and you try to do it all. And then, you know, you're literally attacking your own system because you're not able to calm down and de-stress. So I think that this idea of really evaluating your life and coming up with, you know, a plan of some sort. For me, I don't necessarily have a vision board, but I came up with like the, what do I want my life to look like in 5 years or 10 years? And are the things that I'm doing today going to get me there? And I think that really, not to say that today doesn't matter, because every day matters, but when you're thinking about your life overall, I think I live in a very affluent area of the United States. I mean, the United States is affluent in and of itself. And I live in, I think it's the number one or number two highest cost of living in 2014. And so, you know, everybody here drives super expensive cars, and everybody is buying houses hours away from where they work in order to have, you know, big, humongous houses. And if that's the choice that people want to make, you know, albeit I'm not going to be the person to tell them not to, but, you know, Matt and I had, you know, kind of got caught up in the swing of, oh, we could move, we have enough money, we could do this and we could do that, and just kind of were like on that path. And then we took a step back and we're like, but we like where we live and we're happy where we are, and we could just put money in savings and retire early and travel or start a bed and breakfast, or, you know, do all these other things that we really care much more about than having me commute, because like you said, family is really important. So
yeah,
but those were, you know, my personal perspective, like what were important to me. And when we reflected on, well, we could move, you know, to a different part of the country that isn't so expensive, and, you know, I could quit my job and we could be home and just do the paleo thing, we decided that wasn't something we wanted to do. So I think it's also really important for people to kind of be okay with whatever it is that, when you think about your life in the future, it may or may not, like, I don't know. For me personally, I felt a lot of guilt about like, well, I still want to have a job. You know, I still want to be a suburban person. Like, that is something I want. And it took me a while to be okay with that. So I think it's great that, you know, this idea of coming up with the vision that you want to see, and then you're able to also consult with people, as I understand it, right, to help them kind of right. come to that conclusion and get to where they want to be. And it's really up to everybody to decide what they want that to look like for themselves, you know?
Right. And Stacey, like you say, you know, it took you some time to come to terms with the fact that you like living in the suburban environment and that's what you wanted. You know, and so many people look down on that, right? But if that's what you want and what makes you happy, that's the most awesome thing for you. You know, like there is no right or wrong answer. So, you know, for one person, it might be living in Manhattan and living the high life and getting dressed up every day, and that's their thing. For me, it's just the complete opposite. But whatever gets anyone as jazzed up as I am about being outside and not being in a urban environment, then if that gets you as excited as my situation gets me, then you have hit the money pot, really. You know, like, it's really about figuring out what really, really lights you up on the inside and not caring, like, whether that fits into society's expectations of what you should be doing.
I especially want to endorse that.
Yeah. I think it's such an important concept. I think it's something that is a huge challenge for so many people, right? So many people feel like they're stuck. Right. Like they have to. Right. There's their obligations and taking a step back and just, you know, even if it's one small change, right, one small thing that you do differently, that's taking that first step towards, you know, that new life that is what makes you truly happy, I think is a really, really worthwhile step. And, you know, as people are listening and going like, well, yeah, I've got this and this and this and this, right? I don't like my house. I've got this huge mortgage, right? Like, I don't have time to do this. I don't have time to do this other thing, right? As people start, right, I don't want people to feel overwhelmed because, you know, for all of us, this is a journey. But I think, Sarah, your point of taking a moment to reflect, and rather than getting on that grind and just kind of going on automatic and feeling stuck where you are, taking that step back and going, okay, well, where do I want to be? And then starting to make, even if they're small, incremental changes towards that, it's such a powerful, an empowering thing to do, right? It's to know that you're going towards something that is what you want, even if it's a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan, is such a different way to go through your life, right? So if instead of feeling stuck, right, you can have this optimism and this, right, this positive outlook that you are going somewhere that you want to be. And I feel like rather than feeling overwhelmed, which I think whenever we have these more sort of deeper philosophical talks about life, right, it can be really overwhelming. And I love sort of the idea of taking a step back and it being okay if you don't know the answer to some of those questions, right?
And I think that it's just following, making decisions based on what excites you will help guide, point you in the right direction. Even if you don't know what that direction is, follow what really, like, you're like, oh my God, I'm so jazzed about that. Do that thing and don't do that thing that's just like, okay, I guess I should do that. You know, follow, you know, make decisions based on how you feel, and you'll eventually figure it out. But if you know what you need to do, don't worry about the time that it's going to take you to get there. It could be 5 years or 10 years, as you say, but just committing to that time and that plan releases a ton of weight from your shoulders already. You know, it gives that job, maybe you don't like your job, but it pays your way in order to achieve XYZ goals. By committing to that plan and acknowledging that job is actually facilitating this whole process, gives you a whole completely different outlook on it.
That was far more eloquently said than what I was trying to say.
And she added Zed.
She did. Because Canada, because every English-speaking nation in the world other than America says Zed.
You just defended all of America.
I'm sorry, America.
Awesome.
Really, well, I've lived here for 10 years and I really do love it here.
I'm going to just have to wrap it up on that note.
Sarah, can you remind people where they can find you?
Yeah, I'm over on sarahramsden.com. That's Sarah with an H, which is the most important way, the correct way of spelling Sarah. And it's Ramsden, that's RAMSDEN.com. And over there, you'll find the Fearless Fermentation classes that we've all been talking about. You'll also find a place to sign up for my interest list for coaching. I'm starting that in October because I really I'm all about enjoying the summer and being outside. And then also you'll find a sign up and interest list for some outdoors retreats that I'm starting next summer here on Vancouver Island, where we'll be doing all of the activities that I've talked about that I love, as well as group coaching and helping to direct you onto that awesome path that really excites you. So
I love that retreat idea.
I'm totally trying to figure out how to go.
We will definitely make sure that we get links to all that stuff in the show notes. And is there anything else that we didn't mention that you wanted to share with our listeners?
No, I think you got it all.
Okay. Yes. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was a pleasure to speak with you. And hopefully I'll get to see you again at Paleo FX in the future. But if not, keep enjoying that wonderful new life that you've created for yourself and spreading the joy. I think it's a really wonderful mission that you're on, and happy to have helped spread it here today.
Thanks, ladies.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Sorry, I forgot how to add somebody.
Hold on. There's a button that's like...
Yeah, but I had to like friend her in order to be able to...
Yeah, it's been like 5 days since we've recorded, Stacey.